This episode of Lunch Agenda is sponsored by Brian Smith of Compass Real Estate. Brian helped me buy my house 5 years ago and wanted to support Lunch Agenda just like he supports so many of Washington's greatest causes. I encourage you to check him out at compass.com if you're ready to look at houses in D.C. He is the best, and I'm happy to tell you all about it.
Tuned into Full Service Radio.
Full Service Radio.
Full Service.
Full Service.
Full Service.
Full Service Radio.
Hey everyone, welcome to Lunch Agenda on Full Service Radio. We're broadcasting live from the Line Hotel in DC, and I'm your host, Kiko Bourne. Do you ever get the question, why did you go into working in food? I used to say my grandma loved French cooking and talked about food all the time. But as I've dug deeper, I think I and so many of the people I've met and worked with in the food industry have more complicated reasons for choosing this work. I've noticed over my years working in food organizations that many of the people in food jobs haven't always had the most balanced relationship with food in their own personal lives. Today, we'll pick apart whether this correlation between people who work in food and people with disordered eating exists. We'll discuss why it exists, if it does. Whether it's a good or bad thing that people obsessed with our own food come to work in it, and how to move forward acknowledging this reality in ourselves and in our field of work. This is a topic I've wanted to explore on Lunch Agenda since the very beginning, but I've been scared because it's personal, and I haven't known the best way to tackle it. Today, I'm ready to talk about how I struggled with bulimia during and after college. I offer this conversation because what keeps the problem going is the aloneness we feel when we're keeping a habit to ourselves. And I think there's an extra layer of shame that sits with those of us who work in food and aren't sure we have the right to teach healthy eating or feed others if we at one time have struggled to feed ourselves. I want more people to talk about this and handle it openly with friends and family. As you can tell, today's episode will have a different tenor than my usual Lunch Agenda episode. I'm going to skip over Kiko's food news headlines because we have a lot to talk about. And we're going to go right into bringing, and I'm going to go right into bringing other brave voices into this conversation. I have three guests in studio with me, plus a lot of voices who couldn't be in studio but wanted to share their stories today. But before I introduce my in-studio guests, I want to say two things. First, I want to give a heads up that we are going to be talking about disordered eating, and there may be language that's triggering. So if that's something of concern, I encourage you to please turn off this episode and go back to another one. I also want to acknowledge that while listening to this episode, you may be moved to speak with a professional. And if so, the resource I'd recommend based on consulting with other professionals is nationaleatingdisorders.org, which has a contact helpline. I also want to say that I encourage you to please share comments or ideas for future discussion with me at my website, kikosfoodnews.com, because today, together, we're going to open the door on this Lunch Agenda conversation, but I'd like to continue it if you want to help me. So the door is open, and please share with me your thoughts. Hi, Maddie.
Hi, Kiko.
So Maddie Beckwith, was my very first Lunch Agenda guest. So you can go back into the archives and hear her action item for the food system and all that good stuff. One thing that Maddie and I have in common is that we've both worn a lot of food professional hats. For Maddie, it's included working as a server at Palena Restaurant, now shuttered but famous in DC, working over a decade at the nonprofit Fresh Farm, assisting with the opening months at the super popular DC restaurant Maidan, and many more gigs, many more hats. We also have in common the fact that we struggled for many years with eating disorders back before we even knew each other. Maddie, I'm so grateful that just as you were on my side on the day I became a podcast host, you're again on my side as I explore this topic that makes me feel pretty vulnerable.
Thank you for having me back and being willing to discuss it.
Yeah, absolutely. Hi, Petrilli.
Hi.
Patrilli Hernandez is an old pro in the full service studio. Not only has she been a guest on Lunch Agenda talking about early childhood nutrition in my Back in My Food at School series, but she also was interviewed on another awesome full service radio show, Pineapple Radio, just last week about body positivity. Patrilli has over 12 years of professional experience in food. After initially working in the restaurant industry in both back and front of house, she moved over to food education, advocacy, and policy making. Patrilli currently works with the DC early childhood community on raising competent eaters who are confident in their relationship with food. Hi, Lena.
Hi, Kiko.
Lena Salazar is making her Lunch Agenda debut, but she was interviewed in the studio on the very first Pineapple Radio episode, which was about women's relationships with food and our bodies. Born and raised in Colombia, Lena transitioned from a career of over 10 years in international development to become a certified health educator and coach from the Institute for Integrative Nutrition in New York, and launching Live Well, her own health education and coaching business. So just to be clear to the listeners and to my guests one more time, we won't have time today to talk about many of the facets of disordered eating, such as, you know, digging into what causes it too much, or, you know, digging into all of the tactics and tools that you know, some of us have worked with to move beyond disordered eating as an individual. Instead, we're going to really try to stay laser focused on this one nugget of how our own experience with disordered eating has shaped our careers in food, and how those careers have in turn shaped our own personal relationship with food. Capiche?
Capiche.
Capiche.
Okay. And I'll stop talking in a moment. It's worth mentioning, though, that there is a growing body of writing and podcasts and other conversations about eating disorders in the restaurant industry. There's even a website that you three have probably seen called Chefs with Issues, created a couple years ago by Time food editor Kat Kinsman, to give a place for writing and sharing about all different kinds of addictions and mental health issues suffered by restaurant folks. But especially because we're in DC and there are so many food jobs here that aren't in restaurants per se, today's conversation is going to broaden to voices from food nonprofits, food educators, food policymakers, food coaches, and beyond. So we've established that each of you have worked for many years as food professionals. Turning to the other half of this great paradox, you know, the fact that what I've noticed is that there are a lot of food professionals that have a past of struggling with food themselves. What do each of you think qualifies as disordered eating? And briefly, how is that presented in each of your lives? Don't be shy.
Okay, I'll start.
Thanks, Lena.
So I think it all goes to unmanageability, right? And of course, I speak from my own experience and my work with women. And it goes to how your life becomes so insane and your relationship with food becomes so insane that expands to other aspects of your life, mm-hmm. right? So it's not only when you sit down at the table, it's also at work, right? You're reactive or don't have good relationships, you're grumpy, or relationship with men or partner, right? It expands, right? So I think that it's unmanageability and insanity around food. That's how I would qualify or would like illustrate what disordered eating is. Shall I stop or do you want me to continue?
No, I mean, are you willing to share anything about how that presented in your life?
Yeah, I actually, and I've shared this with you, and it's the fact that different to Maddie and Patrilli and you, my career didn't start in food. Right? It was the opposite. And actually, when you were introducing Maddie and sort of like looked at her with those very honest eyes, I almost felt like crying because I was grateful that it sounds crazy, but it was my eating disorder that brought me to this room today. And to be sitting here, a Colombian that was not born and raised in the US, right? I came to the US very recently and I'm sitting in the US at the Line Hotel with these three amazing women, right? When I have nothing to do with food. It was actually my eating disorder that sort of like led me it was not deliberate. It led me to get more interested in food and where it comes from, who produced it, and as a consequence, to the food system. And then it was like I opened this door, and I was like, wow, I just have to quit my job and do this for a living. So that's an explanation of why I'm here and how those things are connected.
Thank you for saying that. You are absolutely a worthy part of our quartet today. We're all lucky to be here, I think.
Absolutely.
Would either of you like to add anything, Patrilla or Maddie?
Yeah. So I think there's a reason of why I got into food. Not only that, I really did enjoy food growing up, and I think a lot of people that have been in my situation can say the same thing. It's easier to hide in the food industry when you have a disordered relationship with food. At the peak of my eating disorder, where it was noticeably visible, was about high school. People were making comments. There was a lot of concern. I just brushed it off. So when I went to college and then dropped out, as soon as I entered the food industry and saw other people that were obsessed with food like I was, but maybe in a different way, it became my hiding place. And so I could justify my behaviors because, oh, I was part of this community. So this is why I do this and this is why I do that. And it carried with me. And I think that I was able to fool a lot of people for many, many years. But at the end of the day, I came to a point where I couldn't fool myself anymore. There's a joke about people, or no, it's not a joke, but it is very well known that a lot of people that go in to study nutrition and dietetics mm-hmm. have struggles with eating disorders mm-hmm. themselves. And so if they go into nutrition counseling or into dietetic counseling, there are people that can, it could go both ways, right? They could seek help and they could use their experience to help their clients. Or unfortunately what I did, I think for a while, was that I became more enveloped in it. Mm-hmm. And I might have done some things that might be perceived as harmful, right, to other people developing unhealthy relationships with food. And that's I think, like, why I'm here today, because the past few years especially, it's not only to heal myself, but it's also to bring my story to the community and say, okay, I might have done some damage. I might have not, but I want to recognize that. And I want to help the community heal. So.
And just moving around the table, because I've promised to share today too, and not just be the questioner. to me, what qualifies as disordered eating is it's a secret. It's something that I had to hold secret and made me feel alone and, you know, sad and miserable for about the period of years that I was struggling with bulimia. And in terms of, actually, I'm going to hold on the why I went into food part, but well, I'll just share it, because I was going to say that I know a lot of interviews do start with the why did you get into this job thing, and I tend to not want to ask that question because I think it's kind of predictable way to start an interview. But I do want us each to share why, and Lena and Patrilli have just shared it. For me, I don't think I got into food because of it necessarily, because in seventh grade, my friends used to call me the food critic at the lunch table. Mm-hmm. My disordered eating didn't present until college. And so, but digging into it with my mom just this weekend, because I love the way that go in public forces you to have a conversation with your family. We came up with other theories about why this happened to me. And she reminded me of the years of trying on clothes and being so unhappy with, even though I wasn't, quote, heavy or fat, that I was unhappy with how my rib cage was big and I didn't look good in anything. And then, you know, she actually shared another theory. She said, honey, maybe we're just hungry. And I couldn't handle that constant hunger. So I think that I really relate, Patrilli, to what you just said, that you were able to find your community of people who were like me, that even though maybe I was really into talking and thinking about food before working in it, that did kind of feel like my people too. Matt, do you want to share anything on
this
topic?
Sure, it's hard for me to keep track of all of the things with all the good things that have been said, but I think in terms of, you might have to refresh my memory on the questions, disordered eating, I think that Lena got that right. I think it's when it becomes unmanageable and when it, you know, starts to take over a larger portion of your life plate than it should, when it's, you know, all you think about or all you do, or it's sort of becomes unbalanced. And I also like the thought of the food business being a place where you can sort of hide in plain sight. I am a little bit different than you were, Kiko, in that I never experienced it as a secret. It was more a way of being sort of connected, like working with another, with a group of people that sort of were in the same pool. I liken it a little bit. I don't know why this analogy keeps coming up for me of, you know, there's a lot of bartenders who are alcoholics.
I was going to say that, yep. Too.
And like, it's very similar to me. And that's what sort of resonated with me. And
yeah, that's a great analogy.
I was late to the eating disorder party, just sort of in terms of statistics. I was not in puberty. I was not a teenage girl. I was, you know, fully grown. So I was a little bit late, and therefore I think things were a little different. But in a lot of ways, which we can talk about later, I actually found the food community to be healing as opposed to triggering or causing.
And we are going to talk about that for sure. And, you know, actually, that's a great segue to a little bit of data, because I did some digging and I really welcome, you know, especially Lena as an expert coach now. But, you know, I know that a couple of you or all of you have done various research and inquiry here. And please feel free to add information. But a key question at the root of the conversation is whether this correlation really exists, whether there really is a higher number of people in the food industry that have experienced disordered eating than within the population as a whole. As a whole, the National Eating Disorders Association says that eating disorders affect 30 million Americans of all body sizes. A 2007 study found that 0.9% of women, 0.3% of men had anorexia during their life. The same year, another study found 3.5% of women and 2% of men had binge eating disorder during their life, making binge eating disorder three times more common than anorexia and bulimia combined. But digging into the research, while I found all this information about overall numbers and I found information about prevalence of eating disorders among certain subsets of the population, among the LGBTQ community, among Division I athletes, among the Jewish population, I didn't find information about the prevalence of among those who work in food. And Lena and Petrilli are shaking their heads, you know. And so I figured in advance of today's conversation, why not try to capture a little bit of data? So I did a survey. But before I share my results, do any of you have any more specific data on this intersection?
No, and I after you and I talked, I actually sort of like digged in and I couldn't find any like scientific data. Like,
okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
I think one thing that also should be considered, I mean,
this isn't not great, but okay.
This isn't a data point, but I mean, I think also when you're considering if there's an incidence in a particular industry, you also have to look of what the gender makeup is of that industry.
Well said.
And how, yep. You know, what percentage of people who are in service or hospitality or
food nonprofits, yeah, or food education
are women versus men, and what incidence of eating disorders are gendered.
Okay, statistician Beckwith, thank you.
Sorry.
Very good point.
And I think something else to consider when we talk about reporting eating disorders in the nutrition and healthcare community is that a lot of disordered eating is normalized. Mm-hmm. And even with the diagnostics, disordered eating is not officially put on your record until you have another indicator, typically weight, that can back that up. And because eating disorders are really common in people of all sizes, someone that has disordered eating that's of my body size, I have a larger body size, a lot of medical practitioners and a lot of nutritionists would dismiss that, saying that I wasn't of a low enough body weight to have an eating disorder.
Even in 2018.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And so conversations like this are incredibly important because it's not just about what the data says, but it's who's dictating the data.
Right.
Right.
Right. Right.
And I think there's a lot of looking at women's bodies, or even if you're more forgiving of how women's bodies look, and looking at them and saying, you're a normal weight, so you must not be disordered.
Yeah.
Which was how I presented. No one would have known, because I was eating lots of healthy food,
but then
I was binging on what I considered unhealthy food. And I
think a lot of, you know, bulimics and binge eaters, which I probably aggregate, are the largest population of disordered eating, do tend to be normal weight, or... Mm-hmm.
Or even slightly above what is considered, and I put this in heavy quotation marks, normal weight.
Right.
And I think also the amount of men that are not reporting their disordered eating behaviors, it's astounding. I mean, you hear stories and you read testimonies of men that have struggled with this, especially athletes, and they don't talk about it. It's just something else that if they talk to someone about it, they'll be written off as well, saying, oh, eating disorders affect women, not men. But I think there has been some research. I've read it, but I can't point to it right now, unfortunately, about the number of eating disorders among men is actually on the rise.
And I would be curious to hear if, I know your data points were not as broad as you wanted them to be, but what percentage, if any, were men? Because I do think, as you said, with men, especially athletes, I can remember in high school a lot of really messed up behaviors being encouraged for men who were in sports, like shedding weight.
Oh,
and
yeah.
How they would do that.
Right, right. And I will just come out and say I tried to get men in on this conversation.
Oh, it's very difficult.
And I failed. But you know, someone said, well, what about, have you tried to like think about male chefs, you know, and just kind of dig in with them? And that might be a next step to broaden it, maybe for the next episode, actually. Lena?
So gathering all of those thoughts, it all goes to sort of like the society, right? And the belief system, right? That's dominant. And that I think these shows precisely help question and just put on the map, right? Like, this should be on the agenda. We should be discussing why, for example, are my clients with disordered eating thinking that it's just like they don't have enough willpower, or they are simply not self, like they don't have discipline. Why am I thinking that this thing that I'm struggling with it's on me? Right? I'm the one who needs to be fixed. I'm broken and I'm alone, right? As you said, Kiko, I'm the only one who has this, right? So, and it's all unintended, if you want to say it, consequence of just the belief system in which we live, right? And of course, that's connected to men and sort of like the taboo around men being weak, etc. But I know there are men. I've been part of fellowships and support groups where there are like a lot of men present.
Right.
Yep.
Thank you. So Maddie alluded to my disappointing data set. I sent out a survey. There were 4 days for the survey. I dropped out of statistics in college, so I did have one friend who's very data savvy helping me. But I did get 90 people to take it in 4 days, and that friend told me that 30 qualifies as a data set. So of the 90 who responded, 26% said that they had an eating disorder, whereas of those who work in the food world, 39% said that they had an eating disorder. So with 39% of the food professionals versus 26, at least, you know, this theory is validated at least by my stilted data set of people that I know and am friends with on social media. Okay.
Yeah, we need to pitch this to a university or something.
Exactly. Sure. Yeah. So that's one of my action items. So let's talk about it. If we assume then that there's something to be said here about this correlation, let's talk about the effect on the work that we do and on ourselves as being part of it. Let's talk about first the work. So something that I think about, and I kind of alluded to this earlier, is what right do I have to teach other people, especially kids, what to eat when I've been lost in feeding myself? Have any of you worried that you could project harmful practices or just perpetuated practices onto others who rely on you as experts? And you know, what would that look like? Maybe not.
No, I definitely have. I mean, that's where I am right now, is kind of assessing the damage. So let's see, for about about 5 or 6 of the 12 years that I've been working in food, I've worked with children, school-age children, and now I'm doing early childhood. And I think back to, I was a nutrition educator at a community-based organization, and I also did a lot of other work as well. And just thinking back to the messaging that I was giving to children, and now when I'm looking through the lens that I am now, which is the effect of disordered eating through nutrition education, I can get beside myself on how I could have not seen potential consequences of what I was teaching. And it's what I believed, right? And it was well-meaning, and I had good intentions, but the saying goes, good intentions pave the way to hell, right? Or hell is paved by the way of good intentions. So I'm at the point of kind of assessing the damage and kind of going back, if I can, using the lens that I have now, to better inform parents, to better inform children, because I think especially when you become a trusted figure in the community, I think it hurts more. It hurts me more personally because people were relying on me as a source of information. So rambling a little bit.
No, I really appreciate your self-reflection and honesty about it.
Yeah, that's where I'm kind of at right
now. Is there one kind of area or example that like you're really committed to kind of a certain kind of message about now that you have thought about this?
So I belong to, and if this is like the starting way I can do it. So one of the things that I've done is that I've signed up for a lot of Facebook groups that have parents where they talk about nutrition, and just being able to reflect and hearing the horror stories where parents are saying that their 5-year or 6-year-old child is coming home from school, saying that they don't want to put on their heavy coat because it makes them look fat, and if you're fat, you die. And that's those are the messages, because they're not developmentally at a point to really understand what this means. Like, this is how they're interpreting this information.
Right. Good, bad,
yeah,
evil.
Good, yeah. Because that's how children at that age, they perceive information. It's
binary.
Yeah. It's very binary. So hearing stories like that, or hearing stories where 7 and 8-year-old, like, they're refusing to eat the food in the parents' house because that food isn't clean. Like, as a 7 or 8-year-old, like, and they're asking, where are you learning this information? A lot of them from their peers, but a lot of it is in a school setting. So it's an anonymous kind of form of a way that I could give feedback, where I can say, you know what, I've been there on the school side. You have a right to talk to the school and stand up for your child and say, this is not okay. Because a lot of what's being taught in schools, the teachers teaching it are not necessarily nutrition experts. They're being told by some higher authority that this is the messaging they have to go with, right? So I think it's about first empowering parents, right, with the right messaging, and then hopefully I hope to kind of be able to work with teachers and kind of higher systems to really let them know how this type of education, also in quotation marks, is having potentially disastrous effect.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, I'm not even aware of all these Facebook groups. You'll have to clue me in later. Lena, what about you? You know, you're a certified health educator and coach. Do you bring your own story into your practice at all? And basically, how would your practice be different if you didn't have the personal experience to draw from?
It wouldn't exist.
Right. Well, there you go.
It wouldn't exist. And I actually, you know what? I think the work that I do with women, it's kind of liberating, because I don't feel any shame of when I'm sharing like the horrible things that I used to do or the horrible things that happened to me after a horrible binge.
So you do share it, okay.
Oh, I share it like openly. And I don't feel uncomfortable. Like, there's no fear or shame or like, oh, that was so embarrassing. And I find that liberating. And I think that if I didn't do that, probably the work wouldn't be as effective. And something that I emphasize, it's sort of like, this is a journey, and it never ends, sort of like it will end the day you die, right? Like today, actually, I posted on Instagram something about like this. There's no before and after. There's no like a clear line or like, oh, this was before fighting food and this is after. It's more like it's imperceptible, right? It's like a process. It happens gradually. You don't know when it's like, oh God, actually, I feel very sane about around food. That just happens. So I emphasize the fact that it's a process, that it's gradual, that you build it one day at a time, and the fact that I'm also building that journey, right? The fact that I have figured out a few things doesn't mean that I'm done. It means that I'm working on this every day. And sometimes I don't have good days, right? And I tell them. And sometimes when they come to me with certain issues, I'm like, damn it, I'm struggling with the same. Sort of like this mirroring effect, right?
Wow.
And sometimes I share that I'm, you know, struggling with the same, and sometimes I don't. But it's definitely liberating, and it definitely sharing my experiences and being vulnerable definitely helps, you know, them relate and resonate with me and believe in me, trusting me, of course.
Yeah, I mean, I have to say that for the listeners, Lena's blog at livewellway.com, I read certain things and it just, even though I, you know, might not be feeling that today, it reminds me of like specific feelings I've had, and I appreciate the vulnerability you continue to have.
And I need to add something, and it's the fact that, and I don't like when this happens to me, and it's when, of course, when you get into the field, you read more about, you know, other professionals, and you become more like an expert, as you were saying, and you forget the real language. So you become very standard. I don't know, like sometimes, like,
yeah. So like you use a lot of jargon.
Exactly. And I'm like, and I catch myself doing that. I'm like, why am I doing that? Why don't you just go back to when you were struggling with this and go back to those words? What did you need to be told, right? Mm. What were you looking, what explanations were you looking for, right? And I forget. So I have to go back and remind myself where I was and what words, what, because again, I fall into that and I don't want that. Yeah.
Maddie, you were nodding. Did you want to add something?
No, I was just sort of nodding in agreement, but I think this is one place where I feel like I'm not sure that I am a good person to weigh in, because I have not, for better or worse, been a mentor or a teacher or a parent. So I've never had to really worry about how my behaviors or beliefs or actions would affect other people.
Although I would argue that you are a mentor, and you have been. I mean, you always used to tell me that at Fresh Farm, you guys would eat family meals all day long.
Yeah.
And think about the younger or newer or, you know, any staff member who had a good reason to look up to you, they'd be watching you and they'd be seeing what you brought to those group meals. And, you know, we model, right?
That is true. I mean, so, I guess also, for better or worse, I'm not working in a restaurant and deciding portion sizes, because that probably wouldn't be my strong suit. You know, coming from a history of undereating and overeating, that's one area I'm probably a little off on. But I think because I was older when I developed an eating disorder, I did actually have a good life, a good part of time of my life with a healthy relationship with food. So I luckily, you know, when I hear things about children, you know, that's heartbreaking to me, that, you know, that these problems are now surfacing in children with single digit ages.
And even though, you know, the way that I answered the question, it was directed to children, but I don't want to leave out, when it comes to modeling and when it comes to mentoring other women, right? I know that I fell into this trap for a long time. I was actually just talking about it with someone today, how when I would see women that I admired, right, they were successful, they were smart, they were kind, I would also look at their body. I would look at how they look as a model for, okay, well, she is valuable because she is successful and kind and smart, but also because she has this ideal that I want to aspire to. And that could be unrealistic for a lot of people. So even people that I admire, that I know now, no way I could ever modify my body to be like them. I would try. So even though you had your journey with disordered eating as an adult, I'm sure you were surrounded by a lot of peers that probably saw, and they probably, well, whether they did or did not notice. But I think that's something to be mindful of, because I hear that a lot with eating disorders and with addiction. Oh, it's mine. It doesn't affect anybody else. It does.
And I just want to echo something that you just said in terms of, you know, we look at our role models and, you know, judge ourselves based on what we see with them. And that's kind of why I think it's really important that we're having a conversation and we're kind of coming together in solidarity as food professionals, because I think a lot of my listeners are food professionals and they may be struggling and they need to hear that they can talk about it. And so that no matter, you know, I know that a lot of celebrities are coming out. So people who look up to celebrities, you know, can feel empowered by that. And if you look up to athletes, hopefully you've found athletes that are willing to talk about it. And I want us to be food professionals who are willing to talk about it. And so that's why we're here. So let's talk about the way that working in food affected our own issues. And we've kind of already been talking about this, but does anyone else want to share anything about how being in the food profession evolved your own obsession and, you know, either helped you kind of heal or, you know, has perpetuated it, if that's the case for you? You know, I'll share my story just to kind of get the ball rolling. You know, Lena talks about sometimes crazy foods, foods that make us crazy on her website. And, you know, for me, my crazy food was carbs. I demonized carbs. And, you know, when I was binging and purging, it was carbs and sugar. But then, you know, I think my healing years were those years that I worked at Buy Right out in San Francisco. And by at that time, I was still kind of, you know, limiting carbs. But sometimes there would be beautiful loaves of whole grain seed bread around in the staff break room, or these amazing Afghani bolognese filled with lentils or pumpkin and, you know, this buttery bread. And sometimes I would just go to town on those things. But at that time I had been learning about who made those foods and how nutritious they were and what quality of ingredients they were. And so I felt really at peace with keeping them down. And so I guess what I'm saying is, in that way, the work that I was doing in food retail really helped me heal, because I developed such a deeper appreciation for the value of food. Any other stories kind of like that or different from that?
Well, mine's kind of recent. So in 2017, I wanted to kind of branch out in my knowledge about nutrition. And I was hearing a lot about something called intuitive eating among my nutrition circles. And I was interested in learning more about it. So I started listening to a podcast, actually. Kiko, you know my obsession with podcasts.
I do.
And so it was this podcast. Her name's Christy Harrison. And as I was listening, I just kind of started at the beginning. And as it went on, I was like, oh gosh, everything she's talking about, I'm currently experiencing. And like each episode was like literally like ripping off a layer of like years of my experiences. And it took about, you know, I was saying towards the end of the year of 2017, where I finally realized like, wow, what I'm doing is not normal. This is not healthy. Because a lot of my disordered eating actually, it's inherited, which many eating disorders are, whether it's through behavior or even genetically. So I never even knew how bad it was until I finally entered treatment. And there's a saying that says, you know, when a lot of people that have eating disorders, when you finally enter treatment, you always think you're like the least sick person there. and then you come out and then you're like, Whoa, crap. That was pretty bad. So that's pretty recent. And so I'm still in recovery. You know, I been a year out, but I think it's changed my relationship with food to a more neutral place. Like at this point, I mean, don't get me wrong. I love to eat. I've always loved to eat, but, I'm just kind of like more at a not so extreme about it. Mm-hmm. Like I was, it's kind of a neutral approach. Like, okay, I'll take it. I'll leave it. Still great, but it's not going to dominate my life anymore. So, and yeah. I think that's helped my work.
So I don't know if it's this at this point where I kind of like bring up that like event I shared with you about me having lunch with this important guy who works in food systems. And that was when I left the bank where I used to work here in DC, and I just wanted to cause a good impression, right? And the guy was telling me, what, you know, why he was, you know, working in food system and policy advocacy, and he said, well, you know, the farmers and justice, and he asked me, why are you interested in this field? And I'm like, because of my eating disorder. And he kind of looked at me like. And I'm like, oh my God, what did I say? That was so stupid. And I felt so silly, so silly. I was like, really? An eating disorder and food systems? And then, you know, I was reading Francis Morlepe, Diet for a Small Planet. And I was reading, you know, at the beginning of the book where she sort of like explains how she got into food systems. And she talked about her difficult relationship with food. And I was like, great, I'm not that stupid, right? Like, it legitimized me. And that's when, of course, now I tied the dots, right? Now it all makes sense as it happens in life. But when I look back in my recovery, of course, there are many pieces, right? A fellowship, support group, therapy, etc. But a huge piece of it was just learning more about food, right? And again, where my food came from. And just like, I like telling my clients that just we have these glasses or these lens through which we see food and experience food, right? And that's the diet mentality, diet culture lens, right? But then what happened to me in my recovery and what I encourage my clients to do and or help them do is put on these other lenses, which is sort of like the nourishment lens or something like that. So right, where I started like just seeing food with a more neutral view. And it was like, yeah, I mean, yes, sometimes I want to eat the pizza, but I also enjoy my ball of kale or whatever it is, right? But that's just focusing more on real food, on the impact of the food on my body, and also self-knowledge, right? How do I react to certain foods and knowing what works for me? Because again, there's no unique recipe. That's very important to highlight. That's how I see, sort of, that's how I ended up interested in food systems, right? So that's how I see the connection of my eating disorder and how eating real food and that's closer to the land or the earth or whatever like that helped me heal. Again, not that that's the only thing I eat, mm-hmm. not at all, like far from that. But that's how it happened. And it only makes sense now. Back then, I had no idea.
Right, right.
And now I don't feel bad that I said that
in the conversation. Yeah, it seems like a literal grounding.
Yeah.
Like you had to literally ground yourself to like relinquish that power. That
exactly. And I truly believe in the power of food to heal yourself. Your body, your soul, your mind, everything. Food has the power to do that. It's incredible. So that's how I make the connection. And I'm so grateful that happened and that I read that book.
Yeah. Yeah, it is amazing that Francis Morlepe in 1971 was coming out with that.
Uh-huh.
You know, I feel like in the past 5 years, it's like people are brave finally, but she was brave then.
Mm-hmm.
Before I read what my data told me about this, you know, whether it helped or healed the food professionals to work in it with an eating disorder. Can I go ahead, Maddie, or did you want to?
Sure, go ahead. That's sort
so
of where I was going to talk
I did
about.
Ask people, you know, if you did have an eating disorder and you are a food professional, did it, you know, perpetuate your obsession? Did it heal you or did you not see an effect? Of the 18 food professionals who self-reported as having an eating disorder, 10 said working in the field helped heal their disordered eating. 5 said it perpetuated the obsession in a negative way. 2 said they don't think it had an effect. And 1 skipped that question. So that's, you know, 50% of people at this great paradox that we're saying, this intersection, said it presented healing benefits.
Mm-hmm.
And half that many said it prevented the opposite, negative effects. We're going to take a quick break. And afterwards, I'm going to bring a few more voices into this great paradox, or voices of the great paradox into the conversation. And then we'll close with the what can we do part of our conversation. So stay tuned. Do you guys have 10 more minutes? Welcome back to Lunch Agenda. I'm your host, Kiko Bourne, and today we're exploring that great paradox of why so many people who work in food are also the ones who have struggled with eating disorders. I think it's important that I explore this intersection because, oh, I already talked about this, because a lot of my listeners are food professionals, and, you know, I think that we carry shame about doing this work with our personal histories. In the studio, I'm joined by Lena Salazar, Maddie Beckwith, and Patrilli Hernandez, three voices of food industry leaders who are sharing insights from their own work and life in food and exploration of this intersection. But before we continue our conversation, I'd like to share a few perspectives from people who recently shared their stories with me on this topic, but weren't able to be in the studio with us today. So just to be clear, the clips that I'm about to play, quick sound bites, are read by voices that are not the voice of the person who shared it. First, this is a story shared by a culinary educator that I know.
My dad was bulimic, and I hated myself when I was younger, so I soothed myself with food. I was an emotional overeater because I was so lonely and chronically depressed. I needed something creamy to calm me. I remember coming out of a blackout once. There were 16 empty Häagen-Dazs ice cream containers on the floor, and I had absolutely no memory of going to the store to buy them or how many days had passed since I'd been lucid.
The next clip is from a food nonprofit administrator.
I feel a lot of shame in being a foodie who is now a picky eater due to a diagnosis of colitis. The shame runs the gamut, from camping trips when I can't just be easygoing and eat PB&J, to restaurants when I have to awkwardly explain my ish to the waitress. Having so many preferences and, let's face it, opinions about food makes me feel like a bad foodie, bad company, and like I'm torturing myself by choice or otherwise around food.
Here's a restaurant chef.
Food is the first thing I learned to abuse.
This is a food journalist.
I think about how much I was struggling, and so were all these other food writers I know. We kept thinking we were finding answers. But really, we are participating in this mass marketing of disordered eating.
And finally, this is from a food retail entrepreneur.
I have not struggled with anorexia or bulimia, but definitely have had periods of life where I regularly overeat as a semi-effective way to drown out sadness, loneliness. Food is my drug of choice.
Okay, so I just wanted to add those to the conversation to just broaden and broaden so that, again, as many of you listening as possible could hear yourselves in someone today. So what do we do with this information, ladies? This outpouring of people suffering or having suffered and doing food system work. You know, we talked about how it's not a new connection. For decades and decades, there's been, you know, this link. So let's talk about, first of all, you know, ideas we have that will help this. One idea that's already bubbled up today is that maybe universities or the National Eating Disorder Association could turn its attention this way and kind of dig into finding some real research on this intersection, and maybe, you know, publishing around it and you know, normalizing it. But beyond just getting more information and really validating that this paradox exists, how do we end the cycle? And I know that the three women in this room aren't going to give us a golden bullet, but I don't think golden bullet is a phrase. Silver bullet. But
I
know,
golden bullet. Can
you
it be
like
rose
that?
Gold?
Oh, yes.
Gold is, we like gold.
Yes. Okay. All right. We'll be girly about that. So, yeah, I mean, if so many of us working in this good food movement came to it for this reason, what kind of system are we going to create, or how can we avoid future people coming to this work because of the same problem if we even want to avoid that? You know, what has bubbled in your minds about, you know, how this might change? or what we should do at this point of now that we've made the connection. Maddie?
I think your show is a great start. I think part of what, you know, putting it out there and part of how you opened it by saying for you it was this huge secret. And I think the best thing you can do to sort of expose other people or expose your is to expose yourself. I mean, if you're willing to talk about it in these circles, then other people will be willing to talk about it. And when it's not a secret and it's not shameful, you can get treatment. So it's your show is the answer.
We can all go home now. Lena, you've talked up to me. One thing that I've really loved about your wisdom is, you know, you talk about how there's this, you know, historical pattern of educators teaching good and bad foods. And, you know, recently I've seen that instead of good and bad, I don't know that it's the USDA, but certain guidelines are written more often foods, less often foods. But to me, that honestly just kind of feels like code for good and bad. How can we avoid demonizing certain foods for those that we teach, those that we mentor, those that we coach? Any ideas there?
So I think that here I would want to highlight something that it's extremely important. It was extremely important in my recovery and in the work that I do with women. And it's, I don't have an exact answer for that on what words to use or, right? But I think that we easily forget about the body, right? I truly believe that the answers are only always in the body. And just, you know, the pace of society, the crazy lives we live, we forget to listen. We forget mm-hmm. to listen. And we don't need to talk about, like, think what terms, how do we call French fries and how do we call kale? We don't have to think about that if the answers are always in the body and we teach people how to listen or kids how to listen to their body, right? Because it sounds like cliche, but that's where the real wisdom is. It's crazy, but if you pay attention, if you observe your physical sensations or even your thoughts, right? You will gain so much knowledge about yourself, and that should be the criteria to say yes or no to a certain food, not if it's penalized or demonized or if it's going to make me fat or thin or whatever, right? That's how you avoid that sort of like dichotomy and binary world. Binary? I don't know.
Binary.
Okay.
You got it.
So I would want to highlight that, just like coming back to the body. And of course, I mean, we can talk for hours about intuitive eating and mindfulness and meditation and awareness. And those are principles that I don't get tired of promoting, because I am convinced that that's where it should all start.
Yeah. This, it's kind of, you're making a case for a whole unit on mindful eating in food education. I want to give Petrilli a quick chance to very quickly tell us about a bright light that's just come through in food education policy. She shared with me an announcement from the USDA. Will you tell the listeners about what you shared with me last week?
Yeah, I have to pull it up real quick. Hold on. Okay, great. So as of November 19th, the National Eating Disorder Association announced new legislation that amends the existing USDA school and community-based nutrition education and obesity prevention programs to include eating disorder prevention. Now, this is huge. I was just looking up just to verify my facts real quick. Binge eating disorder is not only the most common eating disorder that is diagnosed, it is now... it is now touted as one of the top psychiatric illnesses mm-hmm. that are diagnosed. And anorexia actually has the highest mortality rate out of all psychiatric illness. So it seems like people are waking up to this. And
as a real public health crisis.
Yes, yes. So the initiative is called the Long-Term Investment and Education for Wellness, or Live Well Act, which incorporates evidence-based long-term health practices into the existing USDA grant to protect people with eating disorders and improve overall health outcomes for children.
I want to piggyback on that, because something that came to mind is, like, we're talking about sort of both the intuitive and body listening, which I think is a really big component, and now this additional legislation is the lack of health care and health insurance for people who are in the hospitality industry, generally speaking.
That's a great point.
Wow. And needing, great point.
You know, hospitalization and treatment is very expensive, and working in the food industry often doesn't literally afford you because you don't have health insurance, or practically afford you because you can't take that kind of time off and keep your job.
Mm. So true.
So here we see people who, you know, have this going on in their lives. They might be hiding in their community, in their work, and unable to even seek help. Mm-hmm. Wow.
That's a great point.
Yeah.
Mm, it is.
Okay, well, on that note, I'm going to then bring up one more positive idea that Lena also shared with me. You know, you were talking about this war on obesity, and I think it's relevant because so many of us, myself, policy people like Petrilli, you know, are officially or unofficially part of it because we're working in public administration and education. And Lena, you have such a great idea of an alternate war that would serve us better. Can you just quickly share that?
Yeah, you know, I mean, Petrilli, because of your background and stuff, you know much, probably a lot about this. And it's the fact that talking about the war on obesity has such a negative load, right? It basically, and this is not my idea, right? Like, people have been talking about this for decades. It's that demonizes a certain type of people, right? People that doesn't look the way we think they are supposed to look to be healthy. So if you look behind sort of like the war on the looks of someone, right, on the shape of someone, that's what it is at the end, right? The war on how you look. It should be more on the war on, at the end, it's sort of like how do you call it? Like
you said
a journey towards health, right? It's, what we are interested in, it's health. Right? So it should be more a war on the things that are undermining health that have nothing to do with shape or size, which you're like, are we sleeping enough, right? Are we just like in front of our computers working 18, 20 hours a day or not in front of our computers behind, you know, in the kitchen on our feet, right? Working 20 hours a day. What type of lifestyle are we carrying? Right, so it should be more on a war on the way on our lifestyle and the way we are carrying our lives more than the war on the shape and size of some people, right?
Yeah.
And Petrilli has talked about this in the, you know, in the Pineapple Show and the healthy at every size, the fact that weight is not a proxy for health, right? Mm-hmm. And we cannot judge someone's health on just the size of their jeans or the, you know, their thighs, right? There are so many more indicators that talk about the quality of your health that you cannot just simply judge at first sight, right? Like, how are you sleeping? How's your digestion, right? Like, so many more other things. And that's why I think that war on obesity, it's so dangerous. And it's something that everyone's using worldwide, ugh, right? They talk about agriculture and they talk about, yeah, because the public crisis.
Obesity prevention.
Obesity, exactly, right? And we are so sorry for our kids because they are obese, right? And we have no idea. And of course, these are all like well-intended people, of course. But we have no idea of the sociological and psychological consequences of these words on people and on eating disorder prevalence, right?
Right, right.
And if I can just say, with my work now, reading a lot, looking at research, this war on obesity is creating a new generation of children with disordered eating behaviors.
Yeah, it's the opposite, exactly.
This is not an opinion. This is what's happening. Mm-hmm. And we need to confront that this war on obesity, the methods that we are currently using are not producing good results.
Mm-hmm.
People are getting larger, okay, fine, but the emotional and mental impact that these children are experiencing as a result of this, like, we need to change direction.
How long ago would we say the war on obesity was waged, began?
Late 80s. Okay. I think everything, well, I mean, in terms of diet culture, it's tied to patriarchy and a lot of things. But this wave of this new mainstream dieting really came along in the 80s with a lot of the heart disease research and the remanufacturing of products and this concept of fat-free, light, sugar-free, low-fat, everything. It became an obsession
So let's pivot and let's start talking about the war on the modern lifestyle. Sedentariness, not that that's a word, but mm-hmm. lack of sleep, overstress.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Highly processed foods.
Highly processed food. I mean, listen, I'm from Colombia and I now live in the US and I'm very grateful for this country and the life that I have here. I hope they don't kick me out. But the model, the growth model of the US, and it's something that we are importing to like India, China, Latin America, etc., is this quick, cheap, faster, because that's going to make you more productive and the GDP will grow and GDP, right? And the consequences of that on mental health, on our bodies, on our health are not ideal. So just like the same on the environment, right? If you want to even take it that way, just like this growth model imposes certain practices, behaviors, beliefs that are not good for our mental sanity, for our health.
Right.
So it's basically going against a little bit against the system.
Yep.
And I think like this like cultural value that we place on self-control and on discipline mm-hmm. and on restriction, it is known developmentally as humans, when we feel deprived, we have mm-hmm. we have a genetic response to hoard. That's and right. it yeah. goes with food, and it happens right. with children. You deprive them of food, especially a very basic, the most basic need, and they're going to respond in a way where they have these unhealthy relationships mm. with food. And I think American society is so obsessed with restriction, with being disciplined, with having self-control, where at the end of the day, just like your mom said, maybe we're just hungry and we feel deprived. And if we thought those trigger foods were readily available, we wouldn't want them anymore. Mm-hmm. So yes. I think it's a variety of factors.
Yeah. I think there's also a cultural thing. I mean, Lena probably can speak to this the most because she is from another country and has lived in other countries, but I've spent a little bit of time with extended stays outside of the U.S., and one thing that always stuck with me is when I see people in the U.S., they comment on how I look, and when I see people outside of the U.S., they ask how I feel wow. or what I'm doing,
That's very indicative. Very indicative.
It is. That's a great observation. Maybe it happens when people don't know you well, but because with my family in Colombia, I mean, everyone comments on your body. And that's the first comment. Oh, you look great.
Yeah, you're either too fat or too thin.
Yeah.
Oh, see?
Right. You just look prettier when you're flaquita.
Uh-huh.
Your face looks nicer when you
have to eat less. You're chubby.
Exactly.
Like,
yeah.
What does flaquita mean?
Flaquita means skinny.
Skinny. Oh,
okay. Skinny. Yeah. So it's not a judgment. It's just like you look better when you're yeah. skinny. So they do comment, but now I'm going to pay attention about
yeah.
that.
Right.
Yeah, it's something I've noticed.
So we are to the point of the show when I usually ask my guests for an action item for what listeners can do to improve our food system in any way. But I said earlier that things were going to be a little different today. And so I'm really going to challenge us to think of an action item for ourselves. If you have to offer one to the listeners, okay, fine. But I really want us to be introspective for a moment because this is such a personal journey. And so I'll just kick us off because I know I sprung this on you. I'm going to make a short list of habits I want to model for kids, the kids I teach and my daughter. And you know, some of those habits might come with a backstory that's not so positive. So, for example, I think one of them will be waste as little food as possible. And, you know, they won't need to know the backstory of how much food I wasted down the toilet for years. And that's deep inside of me. But I still think that that's a habit that I'm proud to have them model. And I'm going to be very intentional about that piece. And so I hope to come up with a few others and I will share them. I'll post my little list on Instagram at Kiko Buff in the next couple weeks. So you can all stay tuned for that.
This is a hard one to come up with something for myself. I think I like the idea, which is a little bit playing off of what you just said and sort of like your experiences informing your actions. And I will say, because the thing that I suffered from the most was being restrictive with food that I can try to not, that I can be more generous with other people, not about food, or maybe, but, you know, I can be more generous and more giving and less restrictive.
Because I see you as the most generous. It's just so amazing that you're saying that.
Hey, wow. Like Kiko.
Wow. All right. We'll see that.
This is a very personal thing, and it doesn't apply to everybody with a history of eating disorders, especially when you're still in treatment. But one of the biggest steps that I took towards healing was, and as a healthcare professional, this was big, was to put away that scale.
Put away the scale.
Yes. That is probably one of the top three things that I was obsessed with, because in the healthcare setting, you talk about things like obesity and BMI and how they're an indicator of whether you're a failure at life or whether you're successful. So that dictated about 80% of what I did that day, and getting rid of it. Yep. And really putting it away, like, has been so liberating.
Gorgeous.
Yeah. That's a hard one, especially because I wasn't prepared. I was prepared for, like an action for other people, not me. God, I think I still need to work so hard on compassion and forgiveness towards myself. And also, because I left my job, I had a career in a different field, and this is totally new to me. As in, like, professionally new to me. And I forget that, and I'm impatient, and I do feel like I'm failing sometimes. And I'm like, oh, maybe I should go back to that job where I have the paycheck, right? Things like these podcasts, remind me that I need to keep doing this, and that it just... It's a matter, like, you know, have some patience, compassion, right? Forgiveness, leave aside sort of like the, like, this is where you need to get, and in this how many years or these how many months, these how many books you have to, no. So slowly, compassionate, forgiveness. That's at the top of my list.
Throw away the life skills.
Yeah. Yes. And I do need to give some, like, action item for other people, and it's just like, be curious. Don't, if you listen to this show, don't stop here, right? If Petrilli talked about a resource of the Facebook group, go into that Facebook group. She mentioned a podcast, go into that podcast. Read my blog, or right, reach out to Kiko and give more ideas. Don't stop here. This work takes curiosity, willingness, surrendering, right? And of course, wanting sanity more than you want a number on the scale, right? It's about more like, I want my life back, mm-hmm. than a number on the scale. So just keep being curious, listen to podcasts, go to events, you know, go to research fellowships, etc. Like, I know it sounds cliche, but it's true that you're not alone. And that when you find community and people who say the same crazy things that you think about, then you feel hopeful. So stay curious.
I can't end it any better than that. I think I'm just going to sign off with that. I hope to hear from you all who are listening. I'm so, so, so grateful to Petrilli and Lena and Maddie. And this is Kiko Born signing off from Lunch Agenda. Hope you all have a great day. Thank you.